I love Nebraska. Man, man, oh, man. My name is Scott Redmond, and I'm an alcoholic. And above and beyond my home group and the AA family and that I grew up in and stay sober, and this is my favorite place to be in Alcoholics Anonymous. I know a lot of people in this room, and I spend a considerable amount of time with some people in this room in different places, and they know they've never heard me say that before. This is truly my home group outside of my home group. I love your program. I love what happens in Alcoholics Anonymous out here. There are many people in this room that I've known over a period of years and gotten to know and participate in their lives intimately. And I feel incredibly enriched any time I get to come to Nebraska. I don't know why you keep bringing me out here. You obviously fail to recall with sufficient force the memory of the pain and humiliation of a day, a week, and a second ago. And I rest my case. it's really funny. A friend of mine named Bobby came out of the Harbor Lights in Los Angeles, very glamorous rehab down on Skid Row in L.A., and he got us down there he was being inducted into something called the Hall of Miracles down there. It was for anybody who came out of the Harbor Lights on Skid Row and had been put together 3 years or more of sobriety. And the morning that we were there, 33 people were being inducted into the Hall of Miracles. And unfortunately, and to my great sadness, but it really doesn't matter, there were no TV cameras down there to cover that. To cover 33 people with 3 or more years of sobriety that got out of Skid Row and didn't think their way out of Skid Row. And that morning there was some sound of some screaming kids, and the Salvation Army guy who was running that deal said something to me that has tempered. Sometimes I'll flare up if there's an unruly child in the meeting or just want to. And he said something to me to us that morning I'll never forget. He said, if the children make some noise this morning, please do forgive them because it's the sound of families that shouldn't be together. And I have appreciated that. Now, you know, there's a point of departure for everything. And sometimes just a couple of notes of a song's fine. but it has been a help to me. If you're new, I'd like to welcome you to Alcoholics Anonymous. Why you've elected to come to a group this big when you've already got one in your head is totally beyond me. If your head hits the pillow at night and you're saying, thanks for all coming, I'd like to welcome you to Alcoholics Anonymous. If you are new, and I'd like to tell you I have a great life today. And if you are new, I'm sure that just thrills the crap out of you, you know? I'm sure you're so happy for me. And because I know I was so filled with joy for people having a good time in AA when I got here. And they'd talk about the new house and the car and the family, and I'd sit in my seat and I'd think, well, you know, maybe you'll go home tonight and maybe your house will blow up. Maybe your family will, maybe you'll blow up. Then we'll see how spiritual you are next week. So if you're new here, I'd like to welcome you to AA. If you're wondering when you're going to get in touch with your feelings, stay sober. They'll get in touch with you. I personally think feelings are overrated. I have them whether I want to or not, or whether I sit down and think about them or not. I want to thank all the other speakers. I want to thank my friend Dick for asking me to come talk, and I want to thank the committee for having me on. I want to thank all the other speakers. I unfortunately wasn't able to get in here until yesterday afternoon, and was my life, again, is just tremendously rich by participating in the fellowship out here. And I heard a lot of my friends talk just in the last day and a half, and I want to thank Dick for his talk this morning, and I agree with him. You know, Alcoholics Anonymous has gone from 2 to 2 million, not from one drunk talking to 2,000. It's from one drunk talking to another. And we've gone from 2 to 2 million over this period of years with absolutely no promotion. So, you know, I think we're okay. I think we're just fine. You just can't screw up Alcoholics Anonymous. A lot of people have tried. I certainly tried when I came in, and they just patted me on the head and looked at me in the eyes with that weary look and said, please, please do keep coming back. if you're new here, I was thinking of this story this morning. It's one of my favorite stories, and it was used to be told by a guy at my home group who's no longer with us, and I want to tell it in his honor this morning, and it's about 12-step work. It's one of my favorite stories about 12-step work. And if you're new, I want to share it with you. Is my friend, a guy named Bill W., who was brought up in England, and he used to love to tell this story. And it was a story about an old-timer who had a 12-step call, and he grabbed the newcomer to go with him. And they got into his car, and they drove out into the sticks, out in the boonies, and they drove past the paved road. They're on a dirt road. They drive out to this. They reach this lean-to that doesn't even have a door on it, just a burlap sack, and they go in, and there's this drunk in his shorts on a stained mattress and a candle flickering in a can, and the guy's sucking on a bottle of wine, and that's the only thing in the lean-to. And this new guy with a couple of months looks at this guy and says, "Look, I'm new here. I don't know much about this thing, but there is one thing I know for sure. If you keep drinking, you're going to lose all this." So if you're new, you can carry a message we can't carry, you know? And the fact is, when I was new, I was shown tremendous kindness and generosity by other new people in Alcoholics Anonymous. And the only ones that I didn't benefit from were the ones that were trying to give away something they don't have. A guy who speaks in AA is fond of saying the recovery industry proves absolutely once and for all that you can't give away anything you don't have, but you can sell it. And I would agree with that. Dick was talking this morning about the recovery industry downsizing, and that's certainly what's happening in LA. And it's kind of nice. It really has kind of brought up a signalness of purpose that maybe was getting watered down a lot. But you can't, again, it's just impossible to screw up Alcoholics Anonymous. If you're new here, I don't know what's brought you in. I don't know why you came here this morning. I can only tell you why I came to Alcoholics Anonymous for the first time, and I'm going to share that with you this morning. If you're anything like me and you're new, you are sitting in this room this morning and you are saying to yourself, Alcoholics Anonymous. How did I wind up in Alcoholics Anonymous? How lame is this? This is beyond lame. This is lamer than church, lamer than synagogue. This is some plateau of lameness I never even imagined was available to me. Alcoholics Anonymous. Welcome. Welcome. We're glad you're here. I was brought up in the Bronx in New York City. Anybody from the Bronx? Nope. Witness Protection Program? I like when you're in Montana, you know, and there's one guy who looks like he's there out on a hit or something, you know, and you always, it's the New Yorker in the crowd. I was brought up in a family that was completely out of their mind. My wife never believed me about my family until she met him. And my mom threw an engagement party for us, and my aunt came and wore her wig backwards, and it had a bun on it. And it was not a mistake. It was a look she was going after. She even wore it sort of jauntily askew, kind of beret style. Absolutely nuts. She could have thrown a net over the whole room. And these are my people. I wish I was lying about this. This is my genetic pool, you know. I was not proud of this when I came to AA. If you're new here and you're not an alcoholic, welcome to AA. If you're a drug addict, welcome to AA. If you're a dope fiend, which is somehow worse than any of us, welcome to Alcoholics Anonymous. If you're the Bigfoot of dope addicts, a dope juggernaut, welcome to AA. Just catch alcoholism. You can have anything else you want. Just catch alcoholism. If you don't, you'll die from it, and if you do, you'll live. You know? And you might not have alcoholism. Wouldn't that be terrible? That's like going and applying for cancer. Oh, darn, I don't have cancer. And I was not an alcoholic when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. Number one, I'm Jewish, and Jews don't drink. Because it might dull the pain, you know? Hey, you don't want that to happen. You don't want to squander any agony opportunity that presents itself. So I could not be alcoholic. In addition to being Jewish, I wasn't alcoholic because I had been in psychotherapy for 18 years. I was going to be dead, but I was going to understand it. I was going to be dead with no Oedipal conflict, but really dead. And I was not alcoholic. I was a dark, complicated, adventurous artist, but not alcoholic. So I guess I was like a artistic Jewish patient or something, but I was not alcoholic. So if you don't have alcoholism, welcome to Alcoholics Anonymous. Stick around. I caught it at AA meetings. That's where I caught alcoholism. I got it from you guys. We'd love to give it to you. You know, my sponsor's fond of saying the infection takes place at the meetings. It enters through the ear, infects the whole person, then starts infecting everybody around them. And that is certainly what happened to me when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. And I forgot to do some in Nebraska, and I can't believe that I forgot to do it. Thanks to Alcoholics Anonymous, good sponsorship, and the grace of God, I have not had a drink since April 22nd, 1985. And I thought my father was a real loser when I was a kid, and my father never made more than $10,000 a year, and my brother and I never went to school with ripped clothing and never missed a meal. And I thought my father was a sap. My last year out there, I made $80,000. My children did go to school with ripped clothing, and they did miss meals. How can such a thing possibly happen? How can you put those two pictures down of those two men, and how can I come up with the fact that my dad's a loser and I'm not? Once a certain kind of thinking becomes established in you, anything can happen. It says in our book, if you're new, that if a certain kind of thinking becomes established in you, you're probably beyond human help. Always good news for the new man. I'm even going to tell you what we're going to do to you. I'm going to tell you, you can look it up and read it, and then we're going to do it anyway. It says in the sadistic seventh chapter of our book, a terrible, terrible document. It says, get a man while he's down, crushed up, you know, an eyelid glued to his forehead. I mean, just, you know, where he's had a part of his body shaved he didn't know he even had, you know. And talk to him then. Go. That's when you got to talk to him. Get him then. Talk to him. Get him to laugh with you. Get him to cry with you. Get his confidence. And then once you've got it, heap upon him evidence as to the hopelessness of his situation. Always good news for the new man. And I swore I wouldn't be like my dad, and I started drinking at a real young age. I was introduced to an Old Testament God that I would not be caught in a dark alley with. This God got your ass no matter what. He turned your wife to salt and killed your goat and put a finger in your eye and got you. Got you no matter what. And I was going to Hebrew school. I was kind of a hip, slick, kick, cool kid growing up in the Bronx. And my Hebrew name was Shlomo. James Dean. Shlomo. What am I going to do? If there are any Shlomos in the audience, which in Omaha, the chances are terribly slim, I apologize. I'm not knocking Shlomo. It's just, for me, it's a place I didn't want to be. And I wanted a Shlomoectomy is what I wanted. I tried to get into a gang. I was being brought in this gang by this guy, George. There was a circle of guys around me, and this guy, George, said, look, so they were drinking beer, and I wanted to hang out with them. He said, look, we just do Chevy Biscaynes and Fairlanes, because you knock out the fly window, get in on the column, the ignition. In those days, Chevy Biscaynes and Fairlanes had off, on, and lock. And these guys are around me. They're looking at me. I'm like, you know, moving up in the world here. And he said, if it's on lock, shine the car. Find another car. He said, if it's on off, take your house key off, put it in the ignition, and take off. I said, what if it's on? He said, then someone's in the car, you moron. And I failed Gang 101, you know. So I gravitated to another group of people in my neighborhood. They were wearing bell-bottoms. At that time, if you even got on a New York City bus with bell-bottom jeans, people moved away from you on the bus. man, people move away from you. I got to be there. You know, I mean, that's, you know, you're really making your mark. So I started hanging out with them, and I found the second way that I avoided catching alcoholism. I was put in psychotherapy at a very young age because I had some terrible things happen to me. People were doing things behind my back and talking behind my back and thinking behind my back. And it's hard to catch them, but you can. But it was terrible. And I was asked to leave a number of educational institutions, and I was put in psychotherapy. And then once I hooked up with these guys, I couldn't stop drinking already at 14. And what I did was they introduced me to marijuana, and I overcame my alcohol problem with marijuana. I'd like to welcome all the pot smokers here this morning. You remember WOW, right? WOW. Right after WOW usually came, what? What? WOW, what? WOW, what? Watching a pot smoker is like watching a dog try to run on linoleum, you know? There's a lot of activity, but no movement. But there's a lot of stuff going on there. I conquered my marijuana problem with pills. I was victorious over pills with cocaine. Cocaine's a fabulous drug. It's particularly good for sex if you enjoy sex from the Neolithic period. And I overcame that gall-darn cocaine with heroin. Heroin's a good, complicated, dark, artistic drug. And then you cross the line and become a vomiting pig. It's just a little hop, skip, and a jump. And then I drank till I didn't want to be a drunk, and I drank throughout. And I managed to not even begin to catch alcoholism until I was almost dead from it at 33 years old. Until I was almost dead from it, my wife was almost dead from it, and my children were sick and dying from it. And watching my friend Dick this morning when his grandson walked in the room is the story of Alcoholics Anonymous for me. That's it. I didn't have to hear or see anything else. I don't have to experience anything in Alcoholics Anonymous. Once I get to know a guy, and I know where he comes from, and I know how thick the ice got around his heart, and then I see the grace of God enter him and touch him in a way that he cannot control, cannot predict, cannot pose, I know I am in a place where words don't matter, where ultimately all that matters is what exactly is going on here, which is I could not drink, I don't drink, a miracle is happening in my life. That's it. It's the miracle that makes everything else possible. And if you are not an alcoholic, that means you can't have a miracle. If you don't catch alcoholism, the miracle here is not available to you. Because the miracle is people who can't stop drinking don't drink here. The not drinking part is a moose. If it was not for the not drinking part, we'd be a bigger organization. There's no question about it. Sometimes I'll go to a meeting, I won't even hear a passing reference made to God, the big book of the steps. I get confused if all I'm hearing is about issues and boundaries. You got to not drink to have an issue or a boundary. Don't drink. You'll have them both. I guarantee you. But you got to not drink. I grew up in this house, and I was a young man, and my father had a massive stroke, and I had shot some heroin that day, and I could not show up for my father during his death. I couldn't be there for him, for my brother or my mother, and I felt like an animal. The curtain was down, and I collapsed. I completely collapsed and failed as a brother, as a son, and as a man. I never felt like a grown man anyway. My whole life, I stood next to men 10 years younger than me and said, geez, I wonder what it's like to be grown up. That's a crappy way to live. You're never in your life. You're always almost having a life, but you're never quite in the life. And I never knew why I never felt like a grown man. And it wasn't until I came to AA and did the work that I found out it's because I didn't act like one. And once I started acting like one, I started feeling like one. And I knew what the problem was that morning, and I knew how to solve it. And I swore I would never put a needle in my arm again, because that was the problem. And then I went about the next 12 years destroying my life and everybody around me as best I possibly could. I had set some lofty goals for myself as a young man, and by the time I got to Alcoholics Anonymous, I had reached or surpassed them all. By the time I got here, I had had a book on the bestseller list. I had directed a play. I directed a television show. I had had my own theater in New York. I had acted in a Broadway play. I had done all of these things a time. I never got to do any of them more than once. Because people were horrible to me, you know. Horrible to me. If you're new here, I'd like to share with you my favorite, what used to be my favorite sentence in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I'd like to share with you tonight. You can go home and read it if you're feeling bad later on. If you open up our book into the description of the fourth step, it says after you make a list of the resentments, it says there's a paragraph at the bottom. It's assuming you're taking a look at the resentments that you've written down. And it says when you look at that list, the first thing that was apparent was the world and its people were often quite wrong. Close that book. That's enough for today. I just used to go home and read that sentence, close that book. Don't read the next two pages. Because they'll save your life. And I didn't for 13 years. And I drank till I didn't want to be a drunk, smoked pot till I didn't want to be a pothead, and had chronic success. I met a woman who was an usherette in the Broadway theater I was acting in. It was an incredibly, incredibly romantic experience. She sends her regards to all of her friends in Nebraska, my beautiful wife Nancy, who knows and loves a lot of people here, and a lot of people have been asking for her this weekend. And we were looking at each other. We were together for a couple of weeks, and we were looking at each other. She was looking in my eyes, and she looked at me, and she said, "You're trouble, aren't you?" And I said, yeah. We celebrated 20 years of marriage 2 months ago. And I didn't quite understand my wife's disease until we were in the program for a while, and I was talking about the rush of a drink, and she said, "Do you know what it's like to get a drunk nuts? To get him completely nuts. And once he is nuts, he's up four hat sizes. The vein on his neck is pumping like a garden hose. He's nuts. Then it's time to get in his face. Then it's time to get right up there nose to nose, you know, and feel that spray while he's talking to you." She says it's like the smell of napalm in the morning, you know. Man, there's nothing better. Nothing better. I went, wow, she is sick. This woman is sick. I've been lying, cheating, and stealing all day to get a drug that'll make me vomit. If it's good. Right? And she's sick. And we fell in love. And we had some great times. We had some great, great times being a young couple in New York City and being on Broadway. And I mean, we had a great time. We didn't know that we were dead at the gate. We didn't know we had alcoholism. We didn't know we were just a couple of dogs trying to run on linoleum, man. We were going nowhere fast. And we had two children who became grievously sick from alcoholism. When Michael was born, our older son, we were surrounded by friends and family. There was a ton of phone calls. There were loads of people in the hospital. 2 years and 9 months later, when Jesse was born, there was no one at the hospital, no phone calls, no flowers. We had been completely isolated by the disease in 2 years and 9 months. The ice around our heart had become so thick that it had repelled everybody. And it's not that people didn't love us. It just hurt too much to be around us. And Jesse had something called transitive tachypnea of the heart when he was born, a condition which subsided. But he was taken to neonatal intensive care, and there was nobody at the hospital. And this doctor called me, and Nancy was just falling apart. She was all alone in the hospital with this baby's upstairs in an incubator. And this doctor called me at home and said, "Mr. Redmond, your wife and your child really need you down here." And I said, "I understand that, but the fact is I can't find anybody to watch my two-year-old son. I can't come on down there." And a doctor who I had never met before in my life said something extraordinary to me on that phone that day. She said, "I'll tell you what, I'll give you my address. Why don't you bring your son over to my house and my husband will watch him for you so you can come down here and be with your wife and your son." And I said no. I said no because I could not accept the help. I was too racked by guilt and self-loathing. Now, I had not done Micah a favor. Now he was locked at home with this completely insane man. I would have done better to take him to the hospital and leave him in the waiting room with a coloring book. At least he could have gotten away from me, you know, for a while. And this is where we wound up, from rearranging our life to accommodate a trip we could not stop taking. And Micah came to me, he was about 5 years old, and he said to me, "Dad, is there anything such as God?" And I said to my perfect 5-year-old, beautiful baby boy, "No. No, there isn't, son." And not only did I lie to him, not only did I give him bad information, but I did the thing that was diametrically opposed to what I thought I was doing. You see, what I thought I was doing is I thought I was giving him the real deal. I thought I was saving him some skin, that I was giving him the real story, the real existential story, that I wasn't going to let him be played like a sap or a sucker, like the saps and suckers like my old man, that I was going to save him some time. And in reality, I gave him the weakest, mushiest, fakest, most cowardly thinking you could possibly give to a kid. Because in order to tell him that, you have to stand in the presence of all this immutable law. You have to stand in the presence of everything around us and close your eyes. I thought I was giving him the brave way, and I was showing him the coward's way out. And what I did was I told a little 5-year-old baby, what I told him was, when your head hits the pillow at night and you get scared, tough, because that's all there is. There's you in the darkness, babe, and that's all there is. And I didn't know this, and I didn't know this that I had even done this until I was sober for a while, because if I had realized it when I was new, I don't know what would have happened. I don't know if I could have stayed here. I don't know if I could have kept a gun out of my mouth. If I really got what I had done when I got here, I don't know if I could have stuck around. One thing that happens when we have AA and Al-Anon functions at our house is the newcomers' kids always bring guns over. And if the parents try to take them away, Nancy and I say, they need the guns. They'll tell you when they're ready to leave the guns home. Get them bigger guns. Get them a Nerf bazooka. Get them whatever they need, because they need equipment right now. They're coming out of, you're getting treated, and they're getting a residual treatment. And that can even be a little slower. Sometimes it's fast. But whenever there's a shiny new Beretta in my backyard, I know there's a newcomer there, you know. Nancy and I got real sick. Nancy became very, very ill. One day I came home and popped a cork on a bottle of wine and emptied the entire bottle of wine into this 32-ounce iced tea tumbler. And I turned around and Nancy was giving me the pre-Al-Anon rat face. Yeah. Cliff Roach does that really good, doesn't he? I said, "What?" She said, "What are you doing?" And I said, "I'm having a glass of wine." You know? Can't a man have a glass of wine in his own home? We really became sick. At one point, Nancy came home, and I had an idea to cook something, and I died in the middle of the idea. She came in, I had a plate of eggs on my chest, the oven was on, and I was dead. I was purple on the floor, and she tapped me with her foot, and she said, "How are you?" And I said, "I am really tired." So she called a doctor and described me, floor, empty vial, and the doctor said, "Why are you calling me? There's a blue Jew on the floor of your kitchen. Why are you calling me? And why aren't you calling the paramedics?" And when my wife tells this, it sends a little chill up my spine, because she always says, "I hung up the phone and thought about it." Could have a different speaker here this morning. Then she called another doctor for a second opinion. By the time I got to Alcoholics Anonymous, our older son, Micah, was making involuntary clicking noises, which he couldn't stop making. He couldn't stop grinding his teeth, and he read years below and wrote years below his grade level because his small motor skills were so screwed up because he was distracted from being scared all the time. All the time. That's what happens when you live in a psychological theme park. What dad will be coming home today? What ride will we be on? It was a crapshoot. And this is the the sick, insane home that came to Alcoholics Anonymous on April 22, 1985. On April 20, 1985, I crossed the line I swore I would never cross again. I put a needle in my arm, and that was the thing I knew. As long as I didn't cross that line, as long as I just drank and killed you, as long as I didn't put a needle in my arm, I was okay. And I crossed the line that morning. Why? Why not? It was time. It's when a newcomer tells me he's getting nuts when he's about 30 or 45 days. I say, well, it's time for you to drink. And he goes, that's right. And I say, and don't. But it explains a lot. It's time for you to drink. It's for 30, 45 days. It's time for you to drink. So if you don't drink, you better get, or I strongly urge you to get, that something extraordinary has happened. Can you imagine that? When you want to drink, don't. What are they talking about? I mean, it was an equation. I didn't even have the math skills to take that equation in. I crossed the line. I swore I would never cross again. I called my therapist of record that morning, my first Jungian therapist. I had never been to a Jungian therapist. I mentioned that because it was very important to me. Because when I came to AA and I read our book, I was to find out that Carl Jung played no small role in the founding of Alcoholics Anonymous. Because Carl Jung said to the man who 12-stepped Bill Wilson, he said to him the exact same thing my therapist said to me that morning. And I didn't know it until I read it in our book. And man, it helped me stay around here one day at a time. My therapist said to me, there's absolutely nothing that can be done for you. And I said, what? He said, I can't help you. The only thing I can suggest is you attend a meeting of Narcotics Anonymous, Alcoholics Anonymous, or we have you institutionalized. Why I went to that AA meeting, I have no idea. But I hated it. I hated everything about it. Everything was a miracle. Miracle, miracle, miracle. Miracle. The furniture's a miracle. The coffee's a miracle. Miracle, miracle. I mean, I couldn't, but my skin still crawls when I think of it now, you know? And they get right up in your face and talk that long AA crap to you, you know? It's usually a guy with one tooth with a cavity in it, right? Do I want what you've got? No! No, but thanks for spitting on me. America. I don't know why I stuck around here. The only thing I can possibly think of is I stuck around because I was out of plans. And if you're new here, I pray for you that you're out of plans. If you're new here and you have a plan, it's probably a beaut. Don't use your plan. Grab one of us after the meeting and tell us your plan. We want to know the plan. I have a favorite newcomer plan. It's the single most used newcomer plan that I've been exposed to in the last 5 years. It's the one more dope deal to set myself up for sobriety plan. It's going to wind up on the soft literature rack eventually because this sucker is out there. It's in use. And the only thing I can come up with, because I hated you and I hated this, was I was out of plans and I kept coming back. And my children stopped becoming quite so frightened. My wife reached out to the Al-Anon family groups. And I started seeing something happening to her in her life. And I was 6 months sober and I knew I was going to drink. I had been here long enough to see the AA drill. People came in, didn't change, didn't do the work, got sick, got sicker, got to the podium, shared their gift with us. And then shared the rest right out of the door. And I'd seen it thousands of times in just 6 months. And then I saw people come in, do the work, change, and get some relief. So I knew I was going to drink. I knew it. And I was enjoying the gift of step none. I was 6 months sober. You know the gift of step none. Nothing. And I asked a guy to sponsor me. And he made sure I had done some reading from the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. He invited me to his apartment. After I'd done that reading, and he spent hours and hours with me for fun and for free, and I couldn't figure out why I was doing it. I didn't know what this guy wanted. But he spent hours, and I kept getting up to try to leave, and he wouldn't let me leave, you know. And he read chapter 5 to me, and on the way through, he took me through the first two steps. We reached step 3, we said a prayer together. And he went back, finished chapter 5, and then gave me instructions on how to do a fourth step from the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. And that's the day I joined AA. That's the day I signed up here. That's the day that I didn't feel like I was stealing a seat from somebody in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. Now, you hear some people say, and I know it's true for them, that they mostly resented themselves. I know it's true for them, and I know it's absolutely not true for me. I hated myself, but nothing compared to how much I hated you. I hated you so much more than I hated me, I can't even describe it. I am not a suicide person. I'm a homicide person. I vastly prefer your death to mine. I always have. You know, I'm not knocking the suicide people. Don't get me wrong. This is not a put-down. That's where I go. You first. I mean, that's just where I go. And so I had a lot of work to do. And took me 3 months. I went back to my sponsor at 9 months of sobriety. Read my fifth step to him. Did step six and seven for the first time. And did my eight-step list. And I've been asked to share about how I'm living joyously with the 12 steps today, so I'm gonna. And please don't take my program as an indictment of yours. I had to put my father on my eight-step list, my wife and my kids, and I had to not put myself on my eight-step list. And I know a lot of people put themselves on their eight-step list. Men I sponsor put themselves on their eight-step list. I don't tell them whether or not to do that. I needed to not be on my eight-step list. I had been making amends to myself, hopefully at your expense, my whole life. And the promises in the way it was laid out were just going to have to be enough for me. You know? If I'm not benefiting from the positive actions that I'm taking in Alcoholics Anonymous, the answer is not that there's something wrong with the 12th step. The 12th step is perfect. This is a perfect spiritual program being delivered by imperfect people. You know? And there has to be something wrong with the way I'm doing service. Every time service has been uncomfortable for me, I change or take a look at the service I'm doing. Newcomers act just like newcomers. What a shock, you know. When a guy calls you up, he says, "How are you?" And you say, "Oh, my wife just blew up. The kids are on fire." And he goes, "Oh, really? My girlfriend's transmission's out." At a certain point, if a guy keeps doing that, there's, you know, probably be helpful to the guy to point that out. But at any rate, I wrote up this eight-step list, and I had to start making amends. And I didn't know what I was going to do. I didn't know what I was going to do with the kids. I could sit down and say, "Gee, boys, I'm so sorry you've had no life. Forgive me." I say, "Nancy, I'm so sorry about this 8-year journey to Hades. Okay?" "I don't think so. And what was I going to do with my dad? He was dead. I couldn't do anything." My sponsor said, "Do your job. Do your job in AA and see what happens." So I had to start doing a lot of lame stuff. You know, I had to start, like, going to flag football games and coaching Little League and lame stuff, you know. First Little League game I went to, my wife shows up and breaks out laughing because she looks over. There's the people in the first base stands, and there's me alone in the sun pissed off, you know. "I'm here. I'm doing my job. I'm making amends. I'm here." The kids were thrilled to see me. "Mr. Redmond's going to blow up, man, I'm telling you." Nuts, you know, nuts. It took me a couple of years for the voices to diminish in number and volume to go over and sit in the stands with the people, to just be with the people. Some months ago, my son Jesse, my beautiful son, the younger communist, had a music recital, and he said, "Dad, where are you going to be? Where are you going to sit?" Because he wants to know where I'm going to sit. And I tell him, and I sit down, and I sat down in the seat in this auditorium, and I looked around, and I said, "Oh, my God, I'm just in the auditorium with the people," you know. And I started to cry, and, you know, everybody moved away from me. You know? Same as the bell bottoms, same deal. They're still moving away from me. And I stopped saying to my kids, "Go do your homework," and I started saying, "Do you need any help with your homework?" Not that I can help them. I mean, I don't understand 3/4 of the stuff they're doing in school, but you see, this is what I can do. I can take some alcohol money and spend it on a tutor. I can take some cocaine money and spend it on some materials. I can go into my kid's school and advocate for him and get them what they're entitled to in terms of resources. I told you how grievously sick the boys were when they came. They needed special education. And if you go in and you ask questions, and you go in and ask for help and try to be helpful instead of going in and making demands, my kids have received an extraordinary education within the Los Angeles Unified School District, which is like one of the most notoriously awful in the world. We've had a great experience in LA schools. My kids have received an extraordinary education in there. We show up. We donate money. You know? We're doing it. Nowhere in the first 164 pages of the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous does it say the road gets narrower. It says it talks about joining us on the broad highway, helping to pack things in the mainstream of life, join us on the firing line of life. It talks about the great reality, the great idea. It talks about big, airy, spacious things. It talks about life becoming more inclusive, not exclusive. And it makes so much sense, because when I got here, I had this pathetic, disgusting, tiny little Scott Redman life. I couldn't go anywhere, and I couldn't do nothing by the time I got here. And it's just gotten bigger and bigger and bigger. And one of the biggest things, and a fundamental change, and I've never seen it planned, I just see it happen, was the day that I actually started taking pleasure in the good fortune of somebody else. And it has multiplied the size of my life immeasurably. Because I'm not only happy about what's going on with me, or sad about what's going on with me, but I can then really participate in the joy of the people, the members of Alcoholics Anonymous and the Al-Anon family groups that I'm intimately involved with. It's an extraordinary thing. Even to hear my friends this weekend share about triumphs they're having over personal problems and anxieties and wedges that they've been continually pulling out between them and God. And this is a war of attrition. We surround the castle and we starve it out. We starve that bad stuff out. It's hard to feel like a bad father when you show up to every Little League game and keep your mouth shut. It's hard. You got to work at feeling bad when you're doing that. You know, when you take some money and you spend it on a computer for your kid, and it's that, you know, I'm not, or even some jeans or the right lunchbox. My kids never had the right stuff. And this is a thing again that I realized way later in sobriety that if I had realized right up, I don't know if I could have made it, because I knew that sometimes my kids did get the right thing. But the thing I wasn't able to admit until much later was even when they got the right thing, it was given to them with such inappropriate excitement and insanity that it felt inappropriate and marked and soiled somehow. The things that were just happening in a pedestrian way in other houses were greeted like, you know, the QE2 had arrived or something in our house. And the kids still, they were still cut out from the pack and marked. And it wasn't until Nancy and I became part of a fellowship and a sisterhood. It wasn't part until we started really removing these alcoholic blocks and really becoming part of what's going on here that our kids started becoming part of it. Early in sobriety, in my first year, I sponsored a guy named Roland. And he used to call my house every night and leave a message on my machine every night. And the tape would say, "Scott, it's Roly. I'm sober. I love you. Good night." And Micah told me, and this is my first year of sobriety, Micah told me 5 years after this that he could not fall asleep until he heard Roland's voice on the tape. And once he heard Roland's voice on the tape, he could let go and drift off to bed because he knew nothing had changed. This is the kid I told there was no God. I had tried to rip God out of his life, and what you guys did was you came over the answering machine. You came over every night. And what I think was happening was he was so anxious and so scared about sounds in the house and stuff like that that he used to stay up until he passed out. But once he heard Roland's voice on the tape, he'd go to sleep. You guys have come in our back door. My friend Kathy, who's an Al-Anon, likes to say, "I knew they were coming for me, you know. I knew Al-Anon was coming for me. And you guys came for us." My wife and I had to stop working on our marriage. My idea of working on a relationship is to talk to you until you change your mind. That's my idea of working on a relationship, is to talk to you until your eyes roll back in your head and you keel over, and on the way down you go, "Oh, okay." We had to start working on ourselves and try to bring a better person to the deal, you know. And in the chapter to the family afterward, it talks about alcoholics tending, when they get sober, to pursue two different misguided courses. One is to try to attain and make up for financial failure, and one is to become spiritual behemoths right out of the gate. And I did a little bit of both, mostly the spiritual behemoth part. And I was talking to friends last night, telling the story. I was talking to my wife, who was acting in some sort of misguided manner, you know, one day. And I said, I just want to be of service to you, honey. And she said, this is a marriage, not a coffee commitment. All right? You want to be in the marriage? Let's have a marriage. You want to have a coffee commitment? Go have a coffee commitment. What she was, I was talking to her from some lofty spiritual place. She was saying, you know, let's go. Come on. I was ragging her one day. I mean, I didn't get that when I'd say to myself, oh, if she loved me, she'd be good with money. It's the same as saying, if you loved me, you'd stop drinking. She was bad with money long before she ever met me, and boy, did I improve her thing with money. But for me to look at her that way is as egocentric and insane and controlling and filled with misunderstanding and misguided ideas as saying, if you loved me, you'd stop drinking. One day I was ragging her about money, ragging her about something, and she looked at me and went, oh, you think I'm well. And she looked at me and said, what do you think I'm doing here? I didn't like that for her. And for me to start really treating my wife as an equal, I realized was starting over a period of time, and it was based exactly in proportion to the intimacy I was able to develop with God. If the day that I was able to look into my wife's eyes as comfortably and filled with joy and relaxation and a feeling of camaraderie as I used to look into the eyes of complete strangers at bars, the day I was able to do that, I really knew that you guys had given me the thing that's in the bottle. Because it is my belief for me that if I do not have the thing that's in the bottle, I will not stay here. I will settle for nothing less. I will settle for nothing less than what's in the bottle. We're a little slower here. You know, we're not quite as quick, and some days we are. You know. And I say that Nancy and I celebrated 20 years of marriage, and we're having a really great, romantic, exciting time together. And I really firmly believe that that is not because God likes us more than people who are getting divorced or are having a lousy experience in their marriage. I don't buy it. We live in the epicenter of sobriety in Sherman Oaks, California, which was destroyed in the earthquake. I mean, just wrecked. And when the earthquake hit, Nancy claimed that I left a footprint on her forehead getting out of bed. But Al-Anons do exaggerate. We all know that. And our place got just, we really got hurt, really ripped up. And shortly after that happened, we were at an AA function out of town, and a woman at this function said to me, oh, thank God that God got us out of L.A. before the quake. And I said, oh, so he likes you, but we're crap. But he likes you. And she said to me, oh, I guess he just felt that you had some lessons to learn. Bartender, hello? Hello, bartender. I'm out of here. I'm out of here. If I got a guy up there saying, get the Redmond boy, get him. You ain't getting out of town, buddy. Picks up my house and goes, ah, go. Now pray. I'm out of here. I don't want anything to do with it. I know that God's keeping her sober. It wouldn't keep me sober for 10 seconds. I would like to see her after her next lesson, perhaps. But I judge no man. Was it a good one? That's just what's happening in my house. I get to show a guy how to stay sober and be happily married. Maybe sometime later I'll be able to show a guy how to stay sober and during a divorce. I still got to do my job in Alcoholics Anonymous, no matter what it is. If I got to show a guy how to stay sober in a refrigerator box or living in a house, I got to do my job in Alcoholics Anonymous. I do not think it's my job in AA to be married. I just think it's my job in AA to show a guy how I'm applying the steps and staying staying sober through a joyous marriage, because I know a joyous marriage could get me drunk just as like anything could get me drunk. If you're new here, I think you're in a very dangerous situation. Sometimes a newcomer will say to me, geez, you know, drinking is the furthest thing from my mind. To which I usually reply, no, your mind is the furthest thing from your mind. Now, this is not a criticism. Let me tell you why I'm sharing this with you. We don't care about how far away, close. We don't care about proximity. Okay? We don't start thinking a little bit about a drink. We see a little drink. It's a little tiny drink. It's on the horizon. The next day, it's a little bigger. We think about it a little more. Incoming, you know? It's this big the next day. We think about it. It doesn't say, it says, boom, you're drunk. Boom, you put whiskey in your milk. Boom, if you have this thing and you don't have this thing. If you have the cycle of spree and remorse, if you've been warped by that, we're going to give you some tools that will put you into a different cycle, the cycle of commitment and surrender, where each surrender makes a little commitment a little bigger possible, and each commitment maybe can make a little bigger surrender possible. It's as powerful, more powerful, because it can win than that cycle of spree and remorse. So if you're new here, we don't care whether or not you're thinking about it. To the best of my knowledge, virtually the entire big book of Alcoholics Anonymous is engineered to try to drive home the fact that it doesn't matter if you're thinking about it or not. That the ideas that you can produce. I love reasons to drink. I love them. I collect them. I have a new favorite. I would like to share it with you today. It's not about proximity. Okay, I was working with this guy for about a minute and a half. He lived with his wife. He was a male prostitute, and he had a gay lover. He called me to tell me he drank. I said, oh, why? Because I want to know. He said, I caught my wife cheating on me. It doesn't get much better than that. You can't write that. So what started happening in our house with our beautiful boys is we became a AA Al-Anon family, and one day I was making Micah lunch. He was a little kid, and this is when I really started seeing my family turn around. And I said, what do you want on your hot dog? He said, I want mustard, onions, and lettuce. And I said, lettuce? He said, yeah, I don't want lettuce. And he walked away, and he came back about 45 minutes later, and he looked at me directly in the eyes, and I'm not altering one syllable. He said, I will never again allow your opinion of what I want affect what I ask for. Sometime after this, my wife said to me, you have to take Mike to the dentist. And I said, I have to take him? Where will you be? And she said, let's see, where will I be? I'll be dancing around the house naked, screaming, I'm not taking him, I'm not taking him. Okay, boss? Nancy came up with a new, I said, I think it'll become a new Al-Anon bumper sticker. We were in the car arguing about something, and she turned to me pristinely and said, you could be right, honey. Not now. Something for the refrigerator magnet. Something. And things really started changing for us. And I want to tell you, I have one thing that I have benefited from immensely. I know what we say when we mean when we say we don't know anything when we get up. You know, I really understand that. And usually, you know, good members of Alcoholics Anonymous will often say that, and the ones that have really helped me are the ones who say, I don't know anything, but this is what I've learned. And then they'll give me valuable information about sober living experience and about bringing the 12 traditions and 12 steps into my life. And turning this faith into works, because without it, the faith is dead. And I have benefited immensely from it. It's how I live my life. It's what I get to do every day. And so if you're new here, and you're concerned about being a AA robot, let AA robot be a lofty goal for you. If you're worried about being brainwashed, maybe it could use a good scrubbing. Worse things could happen. One of the biggest gifts I've received in Alcoholics Anonymous was when I came here, I felt that I had fallen from a lofty perch. I was a professional writer. I was writing screenplays for the biggest movie studios in the world. And at the end of my first year of sobriety, I was up to direct a TV show, get a staff job on a TV show, which paid a lot of dough. And that would have been very beneficial to me in my 12-step work in Alcoholics Anonymous. I would have gotten a chance to be of tremendous help to a lot more people. It would have been good for AA for me to get that job. And I did not get the job and almost drank. And I went to my sponsor. I was humiliated. And he said to me, "I guess you got the show business God, and he has failed you utterly." I said, "What?" He said, you didn't want the job. You needed the job. And you didn't get the job. And you walked away from God because of show business, and you almost drank." And I took direction for him, and I sat down, and I wrote my 10th step. I was resentful at myself for almost drinking. I was resentful at the studio for not giving me the job. And he said to me, "When you do 6 and 7 this time, you had better talk to him, and you better ask him what is going to be necessary for you to do to live in this world, show business or no show business." And humbly ask him to remove these defects. Humbly ask him is not, "Take him if you can, big guy." Humbly isn't, "Take him, you rotten son of a bitch." Humbly is, "Pop, I can't bear this anymore. Can you help me? Can you do this for me and reveal to me what you want me to do for you? Will you show me your work and I will do your work? Will you please do my work?" That's a relationship. It says in the last sentence of chapter 4, when we drew close to him, he revealed himself to us. And this is how he reveals himself to me, in action. And so I said that morning, I did my 6 and 7 step, and I said, "Father, I will do anything. I take show business. You can have show business too. I am willing to do anything." And when I came into AA, I heard people talking about God getting them into relationships, getting them out of relationships, God getting people parking spaces. Not the parking God, not the parking God. What if you don't get a space? Oh, my. And if you have a parking God and he gives you a space, pass it on. Okay, I'm sorry. Bad idea, sorry. And I said, "You can have this too. I'm willing to do anything. I'll do anything for a living. Just please keep me sober." And 3 months later, I was working as a cook on a catering truck. And I looked up to God and I said, "I didn't mean this." No way. We have had a grotesque misunderstanding. In L.A., when they make a movie, a caterer follows the cast and crew around and makes food for them, and you make a lot of dough. It is an extraordinarily good job. But I'm Scott Redman, right? And that first morning on that movie, the executive producer and star was a guy who I had worked with in the business, and he stuck his head on the truck that morning, and he said, "Can I have a burrito?" "Scott?" And I said, "What's happening, man?" "What's happening?" He said, "Is this your truck?" I said, "No, but it's my spatula." And I went home and called the sponsor, and I said, "Oh, we're getting the gift now." Are we getting the gift now? It's a miracle. He said, "Sounds like you've got a resentment. How do they come up with this stuff?" I sit down and I wrote, "I'm resentful at Scott Redman for working on a kitchen truck. It affects my self-esteem, pocketbook, ambition, personal relations, and sex. A 5-bagger for sure." I was resentful at the guy. For what? Being hungry? Wanting a burrito? He was a nice guy. I was resentful at God for putting me on the kitchen truck because God had gotten up that morning and said, "Let's keep Saturn on its axis and get the Jew, get him, put him on a kitchen truck." I mean, the ego is unbelievable. I'm going to keep all the protons in the universe moving around atoms and screw up Scott Redmond's life, you know? Man, it's like you live life as if you are a rabbit in an open field with short grass, man. I mean, that's just where you are, babe. Hi, I'm Prey. So I did that inventory. And I showed up, and I started learning how to give them a dime for my nickel and be proud of what I was doing for a living and bring my pay home. And my kids wanted to know how to be a cook, and I showed them how to cook. And I love cooking and cleaning with my two sons. We love doing it together. And I was able to help some people who thought they had fallen from a height when they came into AA, because I had learned what they had yet to learn, is that if you reach the top rank in Alcoholics Anonymous, which is child of God, there's no place to fall. There's no place to fall in Alcoholics Anonymous. Not when you're one of God's kids. And I really got to help some people. I had a friend named Paul who used to say, he had his prayer, he'd say, "Father, I'm willing to do anything for a living, and I'll do anything, but please don't let it be as bad as what you did to Scott." Because I wound up serving people who I had been my assistant directors and stage managers. I wound up serving food to people I had directed in television shows. And my home group, I used to come with these stories, and they'd roar, as the humiliation got bigger and bigger. And I became happier and happier and freer and freer. And eventually I was offered this. I'd been doing this for a couple of years, and I got a call from a company called Ketchum Public Relations, and they'd offered me this. They told me I was a candidate for this kind of big-time comedy writing job, and I really wanted the job. I did this videotape for them, and I crashed and burned. I got the old brain fever back. I needed this job. It was going to help the men I sponsored if I got the job, you know? And I went nuts before I even found out. I crashed and burned, did the 10th step, called my sponsor, and released it. I get a phone call a couple of days later asking me if I can tell. It was Ketchum Public Relations saying, "You didn't get the job." I was fine. Hang up the phone. The phone rings. It's my catering company saying, "Can you cater this thing up in Lake Arrowhead in the mountains above L.A.?" I said, "Sure." I get up there with the kitchen truck. I get the call sheet. My neck's killing me. And to see who the commercial's for. And it says the commercial is for Ketchum Public Relations. Now I'm feeding them. I'm feeding them now. I look down at the end of the truck. There's a guy with a video camera. I said, "What are you doing?" He said, "I'm taping the making of the commercial." He's taping me. They're taping my humiliation. They're going to go back to New York with the tape. And they're going to look at it and go, "Is that Scott Redmond with the meatloaf?" Oh, the poor son of a bitch. I get home, call the spots, and said, "Oh, we're really getting the gift now. And the miracle's a little bigger." He said, "I guess God had enough writers and needed a few cooks this morning." Then he said, "You know, you told God you wanted to work for Ketchum, you forgot to tell him what you wanted to do." Oh, as long as they're having a good time, you know. Okay. If you're new here, I want to welcome you to AA. I want to tell you that I do feel like a grown man today. And I feel like a grown man, because I clean and cook with my children, and because I go to Little League and flag football games, because I go to concerts at school. And when I wound up back into the stands with the people, finally able to sit in that first base stands a couple of years ago, my son Jesse received one of the great compliments any human being can receive on this planet. He was intentionally walked at a game. Doesn't get much better than that. If you're not a fan, basically that means they're scared of you and they want to get to the weenie behind you, you know. And you know, it really doesn't get a lot better than that. We've all been intentionally walked in our dreams, you know. And, you know, he didn't want to be a geek and jump up and down and scream and yell, so he just put his bat down, and he trotted up the first baseline. And on the way up the first baseline, he turned to me in the first base stands, and he just shot me a little bit of stuff. Just a little bit. Not too much. It's the old man. You don't want to be lame, you know. Just enough. And I could have missed the whole thing. Like Norm used to say, by a second and an inch, I could have missed the whole thing. I was at my sobriety station. That's why I got it. And Jesse, I'm not telling you that my son was intentionally walked because I'm sober in Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm telling you I was at my sobriety station. I got it because I'm sober. Because the times I've spent with men, and I've been with a bunch of them who are crying and drunk on their kid's birthday, and I tell them that story, and they know I know what I'm talking about my drinking, and not because I picked it up in my reading. I carry a message nobody else on the planet can carry. I carry hope and a promise. They might not even believe it's possible for them, but if their plan hasn't worked out, they have no choice to pick up the kit of spiritual tools, not weapons, tools, and move forward. If you're new here, congratulations on being in part of the heart of Alcoholics Anonymous. Congratulations on walking into an AA meeting with active, enthusiastic, committed members of Alcoholics. Alcoholics Anonymous, you couldn't possibly be in better shape. I'm going to tell one story and then I'm going to sit down because you might be having relationship problems if you're new. I was at an AA meeting. I met a guy with a couple of weeks, and he called me when I got home, and he talked to me for an hour. I said, four times, so he'd know I was not dead. In that hour, he described to me that he had been stalking several women, that he had a restraining order taken out against him, but he's 2 weeks sober now. Everything's different. And at the end of the hour, he said, I feel so all alone. I said, what do you mean you feel alone? I hardly even know you, and I just listened to you for an hour without interrupting you. He said, I don't have a woman. And I said to him, well, what exactly would you be bringing to a relationship right now besides stalking skills? What are you bringing to the party? People 2 weeks into remission from leukemia aren't having dating problems. Alcoholics are because our problem mainly rests in our mind. That's the good news and the bad news, because this is the only text that about recovery from a fatal illness that contains the sentence we absolutely insist on enjoying life. There's no book about malaria that says you'll love malaria. Malaria is a hoot. It's a scream. You'll meet other people with malaria. It's fabulous. Then you'll meet people who just caught malaria. It doesn't get any better than that. If you're new here, welcome to Alcoholics Anonymous. Welcome home. Thanks so much for bringing me home to Nebraska.